following the soybean market very closely. In early 1983, we started building bull spread positions in bean oil. We were bullish, so we were long the nearby month of soybean oil and short a deferred month. If there was a shortage and supplies got tight, the nearby month price would go up more than the deferred month, and we would make money. As always, when I started to believe in something, I really believed. I called everybody I knew and told them our story about soybean oil and told them to get involved so they could make some money. If you even thought you knew my name, you had bean oil spreads on. I called everybody, my brother, traders, friends, customers. My secretary heard me tell the story on the phone so many times, she even opened an account and put 5 spreads on for herself. The neat thing about these spreads was you didn't have to put up any initial margin. They were marked to the market at the close of each day, so you had to cover any paper loss, but it didn't require any money to open a position. That enabled us to build up big positions. And I mean big positions. So big that one day the Chicago Board of Trade called to inform me I had exceeded the speculative position limit of 540 spreads. They made me sell out to the point where I was holding only 540 spreads. So not only did I have on 540 spreads, but there were another 700 spreads among all these other people to whom I had told our story. Road to Riches. That summer, Pat and I had planned to do something we had never done, take a real family vacation. We were going to take the kids and travel the Upper East Coast. Things were going so well with business that before we left on vacation, I went out and bought a brand new Porsche 911 convertible. Then I went and spent $11,000 to rent a 45-foot motorhome for the entire month of August. The plan was to leave Chicago, go to Washington, D.C. to visit my brother, Terry, and then head up the East Coast. I had a phone installed in the motorhome so I could keep up with the markets from the road. We left Chicago the first thing in the morning, Monday, August 1st, 1983. About lunchtime, I called Smith from my mobile phone in the motorhome. "Hey, what's the soybean market doing today?" "Beans are 20 cents higher." "Great. Why are we up?" "A weather report calling for unseasonably hot, dry weather for at least the next 10 days. I loved it. While I was on vacation, the soybean crop was going to roast in the worst drought since the Dust Bowl days of 1936-37. I was going to get paid by the market to be on vacation. I thought to myself, maybe we'll go all over the country next year and I'll just trade from on the road. "What's the lumber market doing?" "It's limit down." "Ouch." Well, I was up more in the bean oil than I was down in the lumber, so I was still up on the day. We pulled into my brother's on Wednesday, August 3rd. The next night, some of Terry's friends came over for dinner. They had just seen a new movie about the commodities markets called Trading Places, and they wanted to know all about the commodities markets and the life of a trader. So I stayed up half the night telling them war stories about my experiences in the markets. When they found out about the lumber position I had on that was just killing me, they couldn't believe I could have such a loss and handle it. I also told them about the killing I was making in the soybean oil market. They were all caught up in the conversation because of the movie they had just seen. The next day, lumber was limit down, so I called Smith. "See if you can call somebody and find out why lumber is down so much." He came back with a story that some huge commodities fund was liquidating a large portion to keep from taking delivery of lumber. "Well, okay," I thought to myself. "That's no big deal. The market will start back up after this clown gets out of the market." But the market continued limit down for 3 days. Limit down for 3 days on 50 or 60 contracts adds up to real money. I was down about $70,000. Finally, I started asking Smith some intelligent questions like, "What are the spreads doing? Where is the cash market trading? What is plywood doing?" The bull spreads had been deteriorating for about 8 days or so, but that day they were starting to turn back around. Okay, buy 20 contracts at the market. With the market turning, I figured I would add on to the position so I could make back the money more quickly. Then we left Terry's and continued the vacation. Well, it turned out the day I bought those last 20 contracts was the low in the market for a while, and the market rallied $13.50 per thousand board feet in about a week. Somewhere around Philadelphia, I had gotten about $50,000 of the $70,000 back. Victory out of the jaws of defeat, I thought to myself. I was driving down the Jersey Turnpike, drinking Budweiser, talking on the phone, trading commodities, and thinking I was the neatest guy in the world. Fortunately, the lumber position didn't force any change in the real position, soybean oil. I'd call Smith a couple of times a day to see how the bean oil market was doing. How's it look? Oh, it looks great. Yeah, I thought so. Yeah, we're fine. Yeah, I wish we could buy some more. We would go back and forth like this with the old buddy routine, preaching to the converted. There's nothing worse than two people who have on the same position talking to each other about the position. How's it look? Oh, it looks great. Beans are limit up and so is bean oil. This thing is bullish as hell. Are they still focusing on the weather? Yeah, and also that Fed Chairman Volcker and Treasury Secretary Regan have launched a coordinated intervention in the currency markets with European central banks to push down the value of the U.S. dollar. That'll help our exports and push grain prices up even more, won't it? That's right. After the close on August 11th, the Agriculture Department released a crop report indicating damage to the crop as of an August 1st survey. The market had been up strong for several days going into the report. I called Smith. How's the market? Limit down, and our bull spreads in bean oil are losing some ground. Limit down? Why? I thought the report was bullish, didn't you? Yeah, but Hurricane Alicia has moved into the Gulf of Mexico, and the market thinks the rains from the storm will help the crop in the Mississippi Delta. That's the stupidest thing I ever heard. Alicia isn't going to spawn gentle spring showers. Those storms are going to be so violent they'll probably rip the soybeans right out of the ground. I think the market should be up. The market was limit down again the next day, and the bull spreads in oil lost some more ground. One of the oldest rules of trading is, if a market is hit with very bullish news, and instead of going up, the market goes down, get out if you're long. An unexpected and opposite reaction means there is something seriously wrong with the position. Two consecutive limit down days following the release of a supposedly bullish government report does not indicate a strong market. Faced with that situation, what did these two bold and committed traders do? Get out or confidently hold on to their position and opinion? That's right. We decided the market was wrong, and we were not going to let them get us out of this great position. Within days, the market turned and was moving our way again. Break the rules, maintain your conviction, and reap the rewards. Our courage under fire was about to be rewarded. The evening of Wednesday, August 24th, we pulled into Larry Broderick's lake house just outside of Cleveland. We were wrapping up the vacation, and I wanted to be back in the office the following Monday. Larry and I got up the next morning and went into his office in the house, made some phone calls, watched the markets a little bit, and then went out onto the dock. At the end of the dock, he had a quote machine, a phone, and a little refrigerator. We were sitting out in the sun on the last Thursday in August, 1983, watching our market positions, drinking a beer, and thinking life couldn't get any better. But it did. Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday of that week, the bean oil market had closed limit up, so the spreads hadn't made or lost any money for us. But on Thursday, the spreads started to trade. The September bean oil that we were long went up 150 points, and the January month that we were short went up only 80 points. The contracts further out closed lower on the day. The bull spreads were working like a charm. At the end of the day, I had made $248,000. In one day, $250,000. Now remember that all the people I knew in the whole world had these bean oil spreads on. My secretary made $2,400 that day. That's real money when you're making $35,000 a year. Broderick made almost $50,000. Including all the people I had told about this bean oil trade, we were up almost $700,000 in one day. I was getting calls from all over the country telling me how great this was and how smart I was. And I agreed. Yes, I am so smart. But this is just the beginning. This bean oil market has a long way to go, and we are all going to get rich. I also heard through our contacts in the market, since now we were pretty big players in the bean oil market, that it looked like the primary guy on the other side of this trade from us was none other than the legendary trader Richard Dennis. Richard Dennis, dubbed the Prince of the Pit, borrowed $1,600 from his family in 1970, bought a seat at the minor league Mid-America Commodity Exchange for $1,200, and ran the remaining $400 into a reported $200 million over the next 15 years. "Oh," I said, "that's good news. We're going to take out Richard Dennis. We'll go down in trading history as the guys who took out Richard Dennis. Can you stand it?" Not only were we going to be rich, we were going to be famous, too. The Death Knell Phone Call. The high from being right in the market and making all that money is unbelievable. It cannot be duplicated with drugs. You are totally invincible. You are impervious to all pain. There's nothing bad in the world. It's literally like you expect God to call any minute and ask, "Is it okay if I let the sun come up tomorrow morning?" And after thinking about it for a minute, you'll probably say, "Yeah, go ahead." I called Smith and we mutually congratulated each other on our wisdom and knowledge and for all the money we were now going to make. Not the money we had made, but the money we were going to make. We immediately accepted the money we had made and assumed that it was in our bank accounts. It was ours. We weren't even saying, "Isn't it neat that we made an unconscionable amount of money today?" That was a given. We were talking about all the money we were going to make. That day simply confirmed that we were right. I'll never forget going into Larry's house that afternoon and picking up a copy of the Robb Report. Originally a magazine that listed used Rolls-Royces for sale, it grew into the magazine to list ridiculously expensive things for sale. Real estate for $5 million and up, hunting lodges, estates, whole islands for sale. Everything in this magazine was the most expensive of its kind. If it were selling pens, they'd be priced at $500 each. There was a section on motorhomes, and the Rolls-Royce of motorhomes was a thing called a Bluebird Wander Lodge. I was sitting in the house looking through the Robb Report and honestly thinking about buying a $400,000 motorhome. Why would anyone spend $500,000 for a bus? You'd have to be nuts. I was nuts. I was really thinking about buying this bus. Friday morning I got up, went straight to the quote machine, and sat on the edge of my seat moments before the market opened, saying, "Come on, guys, open this sucker. Let's get going. I want to make some more money." I literally assumed I was going to make more money. The question was not whether I was going to make money. The question was, how much money was I going to make? There was a total presumption of success. What had gone before would continue. The market opened and the spreads corrected about 10 points or so from the previous day's huge rally. But that was $30,000 on my position. No big deal, I thought to myself. Here's another sign of having lost control. Here's someone who has lost $30,000 and is saying, that's not so bad. That's a little nuts, right? I just lost $30,000 in the first 5 minutes of Friday, and I was feeling fine. No problem. Too bad we can't buy more of these. The market came back during the day from down 10 to up 30 points and did it right on the close. Bang! The spreads went our way again. Perfect! You couldn't have written the script any better. Now we had Richard Dennis trapped over the weekend. Or at least we thought we did. We actually had the chutzpah to think it was good news that wonder trader Richard Dennis was on the other side of our position. I made $60,000 that day, but the best part of it was that the market moved perfectly. In the last 5 minutes of trading, the front month rallied sharply. I made $60,000, which meant another $150,000 or so was made by the group. The clients were calling again. Ah, God, this is wonderful! You guys are so smart! Naturally, I agreed with them. On Saturday, my family and I drove back to Chicago. When I returned the motor home, I just turned it in and paid them another $500 or $1,000, whatever it was, to take care of the phone, etc. I just didn't want to bother with stuff. I was above all of that. My attitude was, how much money does it take to make whatever I want to happen happen? Fine, do it. Here's the money. Soybean oil gets slippery. Monday morning I got my brand new Porsche 911 convertible, put the top down, and took the outer drive by Lake Michigan to downtown Chicago. I got into the office at about 7:30, a full 2 hours before the bean market opened. The sofa and chair in my office were covered in some special leather from West Germany. I think the set cost $7,000. The stereo was a $4,000 Bang & Olufsen. Everything in this office was about the most expensive you could make it. It was like the Robb Report. How much can you spend on a desk? Fine, I'll buy it. I had a special desk that was on a copper pedestal coming out from the floor, and the carpeting covered the base of it. On top of the pedestal was a giant 3 foot by 6 foot by 7 inch piece of mahogany. The tabletop looked like it was suspended in midair. The credenza didn't touch the floor either. It was a matching piece of wood bolted to the wall, also looking like it was suspended. When you walked into the office, all you could see was carpet stretching out in front of you, a copper column rising up from the carpet, and two pieces of wood levitating in midair, defying gravity. And that is just what I thought I was doing. Defying gravity. I sat down at my fancy desk on the edge of my chair, waiting for the market to open, ready to have another $50,000 day, and thinking life couldn't get any better than this. This time, I was right. It didn't. When the bean oil market opened that Monday morning, the spreads opened a little against us. By the close of trading, the bean oil spreads had given back most of the gains of the previous 2 days because of rain in the soybean belt over the weekend. I figured it was no big deal since the market had been up so much in recent weeks. It's just a correction in a continuing bull market, I told myself. Besides, it is too late in the growing season for rain to do the crop any good. On Wednesday, August 31st, the oil spreads got smashed again, despite the fact that soybeans were 25 cents higher on rumors the Soviets were negotiating agreements to buy soybeans from the United States. I was sure that with the beans up so much and the Soviet news, it was just a matter of time before the oil market caught up. On Thursday, the whole soybean complex, beans, meal, and oil, collapsed on reports a Soviet jet fighter shot down a Korean Airlines passenger plane. What does the KAL downing have to do with the bean market? I asked. They think we'll impose a grain embargo against the Soviets, just like Carter did when the Russians invaded Afghanistan in 1980, said Smith. That's stupid. The Russians didn't invade Korea. They accidentally shot down a passenger plane. There's no comparison. The market's wrong. We're not going to have a grain embargo. I was right. Over the Labor Day weekend, President Reagan condemned the Soviet assault, but shunned tough retaliation. He refused to disrupt a new grain sales accord. Soybeans rallied sharply on the news, but the bull spreads in the oil market went down again. Once again, I chalked it up to the fact that the oil market had outperformed the beans in August. The beans were playing catch-up, and the oil market was resting before the next leg up. The spreads did stabilize for a couple of days as the market began to focus on the September 12th release of the Agriculture Department's crop report. That report turned out to be wildly bullish. The damage to the crop was more severe than previously thought. Beans opened almost limit up the next day, but closed almost limit down. However, the bull spreads in oil closed higher on the day. Okay, I said to myself, this oil market is starting to turn back to the upside. This whole bull market was driven by the oil market, and bean oil is starting to rally again. This market is turning. But the next day, the oil market collapsed again. Limit down in all contract months, and more than limit down in the spot month, since there were no limits on the spot month. On Friday, the market stabilized and managed to erase about a third of the week's losses. On Monday, September 19th, the bean market and the oil market roared to the upside. Over the weekend, a winter storm system in Canada exploded and was drifting toward the Midwest. This is great, I thought to myself. Just a few weeks after the worst drought since the 1930s wreaked havoc with most of the soybean crop, an early frost threatens to damage what remains. Okay, finally the market is going to turn. This frost is going to revive the bull market. But it wasn't to be. The market just slipped right back down again. I never saw the spread trade better than it had on that last Friday in August when I was at Broderick's Lake House. The decline was relentless, with only occasional spasms to the upside, up $10,000 one day, down $25,000 the next. The market continued to grind lower, and I proceeded to lose about $20,000 to $25,000 a day, every day for months. The clients I advised were sophisticated and experienced traders in their own right, and they had been bailing out of the market since early September. As far as I was concerned, this demonstrated their lack of courage to buy with pride and hold with conviction. Naturally, I didn't get out. I was in for the long pull. This was going to be the big trade. The world was going to run out of bean oil, maybe even mayonnaise, and Smith and I were going to make $10 million. Vertigo. For the next several weeks, Smith and I kept telling each other, it's going to be all right. It's gonna turn. Every news story we heard about the market, we made fit the we are going to be okay scenario. Now we know why the market was down today. Now that we understand that, it's going to go away. We're going to be okay. We rationalized everything. It was like living in Tortilla Flat with Danny and his friends, rationalizing everything. Yeah, we just heard that some big commercial firm has just taken some deliveries of bean oil, so if he's stopping them, then it must be okay now. By the beginning of October, I was underwater. Soybean prices had fallen to the lowest levels in 2 months since the August 11th Agriculture Department crop report predicting a curtailed harvest. Bean oil was now at 29 cents, down from the September highs of 37 cents. I'd lost most of my money. As the position got increasingly worse, I began to get margin calls. I'd be on margin call for 2 or 3 days at a time, but the firm's attitude was, we know you're a big wheel, we know you're on the executive committee at the CME, and we know you're neat, and you've got this fancy car. We know you're good for the money. I'd wait a few days to see if the market rallied. If it did, fine. I wouldn't have to meet the margin call. If it didn't, I'd spend the next couple of days trying to borrow money from my friends so I could meet the margin call. I gradually began to lose my outward cool. I was fighting with Pat and the kids. They had no idea what was happening. But it's not uncommon for the spouses and families of traders not to know what's going on with the traders' market positions. I was skipping dinner so I wouldn't have to face my family. I lost 15 pounds. I couldn't sleep. I was going to bed every night knowing I had to get up the next day and go watch this thing again. It was horrible. It would be a Friday and I'd say, "Okay, it's Friday. I can't lose any more on this for another couple of days because the market won't be open." Weekends were welcomed. It was exactly opposite of when I was making money on that trade. When I was making money, I couldn't wait for the market to open. When I was losing money, I couldn't wait for it to close. Time is very painful when you're losing money. All I wanted was for the market to rally back to the August highs and I'd get out. We refused to accept the obvious, that we were going under. We were holding each other's hands, and every day we went through this little drill of losing an average of $20,000 to $25,000, but telling ourselves that it was going to be all right. Naturally, it never was. It got to be excruciatingly painful, but I couldn't get out of the market because as long as I had the position on, there was always the belief, the chance, the hope that I could make back the money. If I got out of the market, there wouldn't be any chance anymore. Tomorrow is the first day of the rest of my life. It's going to turn tomorrow. It was always going to turn tomorrow. But it never did. By the first week in November, I was underwater big time, $200,000 or $300,000. Bean oil was at 25 cents. So from the high of August, I was down about $700,000 or $800,000. What was worse is that I'd borrowed money from my friends to the tune of about $400,000. I got another margin call in mid-November, but I didn't want to borrow any more money from my friends. So I decided to ride out the storm again to see if the market would rally enough to take me off the margin call. On November 17th, one of the senior managers from the brokerage firm came into my office and started liquidating my position. The firm finally and mercifully pulled the plug on me because I couldn't do it myself. They not only liquidated the account, but they also started seizing whatever assets I had. They took my membership and sold it, which forced me to resign from the Board of Governors and the Executive Committee, since you can't be on the board if you're not a member of the exchange. Then they literally started to take the stuff out of the office, the furniture, the stereo, and the levitating desk and credenza. I can remember sitting at my desk crying as they started to strip the office. It was the absolute lowest point in my life. I had gone from having everything on August 31st to nothing on November 17th. I couldn't stand to watch them take all the stuff away, so I took the pictures of my family off the wall, put them in a box, and walked out of the office. I vaguely remember wandering the halls of the exchange for a while, trying to figure out what I was going to do. I couldn't borrow any more money from friends, and my only hope for making money had been the bean oil position. Now it was gone. Well, Pat and I had been through some tough times before. Surely we'd make it through this one, too. Oh, my God. Pat! How was I going to tell Pat what had happened? How was I going to tell her that my 15-year career and all of the money had evaporated in the last 2.5 months? I headed for the River Club at the exchange to sort things out over a Jack Daniels. Several hours and several drinks later, I weaved my way to the Porsche. I remember deciding the only way I could ever get out of this for my family was to kill myself. I had about $1 million worth of life insurance, and the only way I could make it right for my wife and kids was to hit a bridge at 100 miles per hour. I remember thinking to myself, "Everybody knows I drink too much anyway, so it will look like an accident." I thought the insurance company wouldn't pay if it was suicide. I got on the Kennedy Expressway and started looking for a bridge. I had barely even gotten out of the city when I noticed blue lights flashing in my rearview mirror. I pulled over and waited for the cop to come to the window. "License and registration, please. Any idea how fast you were going, Mr. Paul?" 75, 85. "Try 18. I couldn't believe it. I was so drunk and so dazed over what had happened that I hadn't even gotten out of first gear. I didn't get a speeding ticket. I got a non-speeding ticket, a ticket for careless driving. I was a road hazard because I was doing 18 miles per hour on an expressway in a Porsche. After recovering from the temporary bout of insanity of flirting with suicide, I spent the next 3 weeks in the house. I refinished the living room floor and did a bunch of other little piddly things around the house. I had to act like I was doing something constructive, so I became Mr. Handyman. That was my job. I'd have the TV on the financial news channel like I was watching the market and staying abreast of things, even though I didn't have two dimes to put together to do anything about it. I even kept my charts updated, but it was all phony. I wasn't doing anything. I was just acting like I was doing something. Nader. After about a month, I went to see my old friend from the lumber pit, Stu Gimble. I had no job, no money, and no prospect for either. For some reason, Stu wasn't discouraged at all. He thought it was the best thing that could have happened to me. "This is great. We'll get you back on your feet again. All the great traders have gone bust at least once in their careers. You're gonna be fine." He leased and paid the rent on a seat in the Eurodollar pit for me while he tried to teach me to do what he did. A sudden realization was beginning to set in. I wasn't a trader. I couldn't do it. I wasn't good enough. I literally couldn't do what he did, even though I had the best teacher and conceptually understood what he was doing. I wasn't quick enough. He had this fantastic thing for numbers that was unbelievable, but my brain didn't work like his. So there I was in the Eurodollar pit with no customer business, trying to be a trader, and I couldn't make a living. In September 1984, my accountant figured out that I could refile my previous 3 years' tax returns, average all 3 years' income, and get a tax refund. Combining the losses of 1983 with the money I had made in 82 and 81, I got a check from Uncle Sam for about $100,000. That wasn't much money relative to my dire financial situation, but it was a grubstake. The Eurodollar market was so slow and efficient that there just wasn't much price movement. I was used to the lumber market, which really moved a lot, and I thought that whatever I had learned in the lumber pit would apply better to S&Ps than Eurodollars. I bought an IOM, Index and Option Market, seat for $55,000. I was going to try to trade the S&P 500 Futures Index. I tried that for 5 months, and I didn't make any money doing that either. I wasn't any good at it. Once again, this validated that I didn't know how to trade. I tried to rationalize that away. That is, I hadn't traded in the pit for so long, and I was used to trading from a computer screen in an upstairs office. I sold the seat for $60,000, and that was the last $60,000 I had in the whole world. I hooked back up with Kirby Smith, who was at a small brokerage firm, and we sat in an office every day acting like we were going to trade and make the money back. I played that game until October 1985 and slowly ate up the money. I was still paying for the car, the house, and all the expenses of having a family. You can go through money pretty quickly with those kinds of bills and no money coming in at all. If I didn't get it together soon, I'd have to get a real job. I'd have to go back to work to survive and keep my family alive. I didn't want to do it since I had come to believe I was above all that. You gotta do what you gotta do. However, I didn't intend to give up on trading. I viewed it like blackjack in the caddy pen. I wasn't going to quit playing, but I was going to quit losing. It was time to be a smart man, humbled, but resolved to learn from my mistakes. Five. The Quest. How do the pros make money? Not only did I lose all of my money because of the stupid way I handled the bean oil position, but I also discovered that I'd never really been a trader. Sure, I had made money in the markets, but it turned out that I really didn't know how or why I had made it. I couldn't duplicate the profits when I had to make a living strictly by trading. The money I'd made over the years trading wasn't because I was a good trader. I'd made money because of being a good salesman, being at the right place at the right time and knowing the right people, rather than because of some innate trading ability. It was a painful realization to discover that I wasn't a trader. I didn't have the patience or mechanical skills to be a successful floor trader, nor the consistency to be a successful upstairs trader. If I was going to learn how to make money trading, I was going to have to find out how others had done it. I went and read the books and articles about and interviews with successful market professionals. I studied the best investors and traders from Wall Street and LaSalle Street, Peter Lynch, Bernard Baruch, Jim Rogers, Paul Tudor Jones, Richard Dennis, and many more. After all, when you're sick, you want to consult the best doctors, and when you're in trouble, you want the advice of the best lawyers. So I consulted what the successful pros had to say about making money in the markets. If I could figure out how they did it, I could still pull off getting rich again. And this time, I would keep the money. Here is some of the advice the pros offered for making money. Appendix A has a brief dossier on these pros for those of you not familiar with their names. Advice and Dissent. I haven't met a rich technician. Jim Rogers. I always laugh at people who say, I've never met a rich technician. I love that. It is such an arrogant, nonsensical response. I used fundamentals for 9 years and then got rich as a technician. Marty Schwartz. Not very encouraging. Okay, so maybe the key to success wasn't whether you were a fundamentalist or a technician. I mean, I had made a lot of money using both of these methods. While I found technical analysis indispensable, there was nothing like a good fundamental situation to really make a market move. Maybe another topic would begin to reveal the pros' secret. Diversify your investments. John Templeton. All right, now I was getting somewhere. This was striking a familiar chord. Maybe I had placed too much emphasis on the soybean oil spreads. I had too large a percentage of my capital committed to that market and that trade. Even afterwards, I was trading only one market at a time. This looked like my first lesson from the masters. Diversify. Or it looked that way until I read the following. Diversification is a hedge for ignorance. William O'Neill. Concentrate your investments. If you have a harem of 40 women, you never get to know any of them very well. Warren Buffett. Buffett has made more than $1 billion in the market. Who was I to disagree with him? But Templeton is also one of the greatest investors alive, and he said something totally opposite of Buffett. Okay, so maybe diversification wasn't the answer either. Maybe you could put all of your eggs in one basket and still get rich by watching the basket very closely. Perhaps the topics I had selected so far were too broad in their implications. Certainly the pros would agree on the more specific and practical applications of investment and trading mechanics. Averaging a loss. You have to understand the business of a company you have invested in, or you will not know whether to buy more of it if it goes down. Peter Lynch. Averaging down is an amateur strategy that can produce serious losses. William O'Neill. Top and bottom picking. Don't bottom fish. Peter Lynch. Don't try to buy at the bottom or sell at the top. Bernard Baruch. Maybe the trend is your friend for a few minutes in Chicago, but for the most part, it is rarely a way to get rich. Jim Rogers. I believe the very best money is made at the market turns. Everyone says you get killed trying to pick tops and bottoms, and you make all the money by catching the trends in the middle. Well, for 12 years I have often been missing the meat in the middle, but I have caught a lot of bottoms and tops. Paul Tudor Jones. Spreading up. When you're not sure what is going to happen in the market, it is wise to protect yourself by going short in something you think is overvalued. Roy Neuberger. Whether I am bullish or bearish, I always try to have both long and short positions, just in case I'm wrong. Jim Rogers. I have tried being long a stock and short a stock in the same industry, but generally found it to be unsuccessful. Michael Steinhardt. Many traders have the idea that when they are in a commodity or stock and it starts to decline, they can hedge and protect themselves, that is, short some other commodity or stock and make up the loss. There is no greater mistake than this. W.D. Gann. I had expected there might be some subtle differences among the pros. After all, some were stock market moguls, while others traded options or futures contracts. But didn't these guys agree on anything? Based on the examples above, they sounded more like members of a debate team trying to score points against one another. I had to find out how the pros made money in the markets. I had to learn the secret that all of them must know. But if the pros couldn't agree on how to make money, how was I going to learn their secret? And then it began to occur to me. There was no secret. They didn't all do the same thing to make money. What one guy said not to do, another guy said you should do. Why didn't they agree? I mean, here was a group of individuals who had collectively taken billions of dollars out of the markets and kept it. Weren't they all doing at least a few things the same when they made their money? Think about it this way. If one guy did what another said not to do, how come the first guy didn't lose his money? And if the first guy hadn't lost, why didn't the second guy? If imitating the pros was supposed to make you rich and not imitating them was supposed to make you poor, then each one of these guys should have lost all his money because none of them imitated the others. They all should be flat broke because they very often did things opposite of one another. It finally occurred to me that maybe studying losses was more important than searching for some holy grail to making money. So I started reading through all the material on the pros again and noted what they had to say about losses. Losses. My basic advice is don't lose money. Jim Rogers. I'm more concerned about controlling the downside. Learn to take the losses. The most important thing in making money is not letting your losses get out of hand. Marty Schwartz. I'm always thinking about losing money as opposed to making money. Don't focus on making money. Focus on protecting what you have. Paul Tudor Jones. One investor's two rules of investing. Never lose money. Never forget rule number one. Warren Buffett. The majority of unskilled investors stubbornly hold on to their losses when the losses are small and reasonable. They could get out cheaply, but being emotionally involved and human, they keep waiting and hoping until their loss gets much bigger and costs them dearly. William O'Neill. Learn how to take losses quickly and cleanly. Don't expect to be right all the time. If you have a mistake, cut your loss as quickly as possible. Bernard Baruch. Now I was getting somewhere. Why was I trying to learn the secret to making money when it could be done in so many different ways? I knew something about how to make money. I had made $1 million in the market. but I didn't know anything about how not to lose. The pros could all make money in contradictory ways because they all knew how to control their losses. While one person's method was making money, another person with an opposite approach would be losing if the second person was in the market. And that's just it. The second person wouldn't be in the market. He'd be on the sidelines with a nominal loss. The pros consider it their primary responsibility not to lose money. The moral, of course, is that just as there is more than one way to deal blackjack, there is more than one way to make money in the markets. Obviously, there is no secret way to make money because the pros have done it using very different and often contradictory approaches. Learning how not to lose money is more important than learning how to make money. Unfortunately, the pros didn't explain how to go about acquiring this skill. So I decided to study loss in general, and my losses in particular, to see if I could determine the root causes of losing money in the markets. As I said at the beginning of the book, I may not be wise, but I am now very smart. I eventually did learn from my mistakes. Part 2. Lessons Learned. Good judgment is usually the result of experience, and experience frequently the result of bad judgment. Robert Lovett. What started as a search for the secret to making money had turned into a search for the secret of how not to lose money. Why is it so important to learn how not to lose? Because when people lose money in the markets, they usually look for a new approach to make money. Obviously, the previous method was defective. It's never the investor's or trader's fault. Given the myriad of how-to methods, you could spend a lifetime trying and failing to make money with each one because you don't know how not to lose. On the other hand, if you learn why people lose and thereby control losses, profits will follow. Basically, what I found is that there are as many ways to make money in the markets as there are people in the markets. But there are relatively few ways to lose money. When I say lose here, I don't mean that there won't be any losses. You don't win every point in every game, in every set, in every match in tennis. You win some and you lose some. There will be lots of losses, just as there are losses in any business. Former Citicorp CEO Walter Wriston said that a lender who doesn't have loan losses isn't doing his job. And it's the truth. Trying to avoid taking losses altogether is the loser's curse. But the losses you are trying to avoid are the ones for which you hadn't made allowances, the ones that sneak up on you, and the ones that ultimately put you out of business. Losing money in the markets is the result of either 1, some fault in the analysis, or 2, some fault in its application. As the pros have demonstrated, there is no single surefire analytical way to make money in the markets. Therefore, studying the various analytical methods in search of the best one is a waste of time. Instead, what should be studied are the factors involved in applying or failing to apply any analytical method. Even when equipped with accurate analysis, correct forecasts, and profitable recommendations, people still manage to lose money. Why can't people match the profitable performance records of the market advisory services they subscribe to? They can't because of psychological factors that prevent them from applying the analysis and following the recommendations. Psychological factors can be categorized as either 1, the pathological mental disorders and illnesses that require professional help, or 2, the psychological distortions all of us engage in, even though we are basically mentally healthy. We are interested in the latter. Market lore to ignore? Most remedies for market losses due to psychological factors are old market saws that are too ambiguous to offer any means of practical application. People recite these catchphrases as if they were self-evident truths. After repeating them so often, they become trite clichés used out of unthinking habit. But pearls of trading wisdom are more easily repeated than implemented. Repeating maxims as if mere verbalization will activate the underlying principles will not work. For example, simply following the dictum, "Don't discuss market positions because the pros don't," won't automatically make you a pro. You must understand those principles before you can benefit from the maxims. Pros don't discuss their positions because they understand what triggers discussing positions in the first place, as well as the dangers of doing so. A maxim is a succinct formulation of some fundamental principle or rule of conduct. Memorizing and repeating clichés is easy. Grasping their underlying principles is more difficult. For instance, consider what must be the most quoted maxim in the business. Cut your losses short. Sounds great, but what does it mean? Do you get out of a position as soon as it shows a loss? What constitutes a loss? How do you define a market loss? At some point in almost every investment or trade, the position is going to show a loss. So how do you know when it is really a loss, something to get rid of, and not a position that is going to come back and be profitable? Or how about, don't follow the crowd, go against the herd? Okay, but how do you measure the crowd's position in the market? What are the truest bellwethers of public sentiment? Do you determine what the crowd is doing by looking at volume and open interest? Put-call ratios? Put-to-call premiums? Consumer confidence? Odd-lot shorts? Sentiment numbers and consensus of investment advisors? Besides, doing the opposite of what everyone else is doing doesn't guarantee success, and there are times when trading opposite the crowd can wipe you out. And then there's the oldie but goldie, don't trade on hope or fear or make emotional decisions. Sounds simple enough, but as you will see later in the book, emotions in general and hope and fear specifically create a unique paradox for the market participant. This book will not instruct you on the specifics of how to confront your fears or how to get in touch with your feelings and emotions. It will not reconcile your ego's legitimate internal psychological needs with your participation in the markets. I don't have a battery of tests for you to take to determine your particular psychological profile or your internal conflicts. I don't have a test to determine if you should be participating in the markets at all. I am not, nor do I pretend to be, a psychologist. But I don't have to be a psychologist to know that losses caused by psychological factors presuppose your ego's involvement in the market position in the first place, which means you have personalized the market. Knowing what causes something is the first step in preventing it from going into effect. If we can determine how a market position gets personalized, that is, how ego gets involved, we will be well on our way to preventing it from happening. Then the losses due to psychological factors can be prevented. Some of the ideas in the rest of the book may sound like semantic quibbling. However, it is precisely those confused semantics that are largely responsible for the confused thinking that, in turn, leads to the losses due to psychological factors. To clear up that confusion, let's attach clear, specific meanings to the terms we use. Let's start at the beginning by defining psychology and seeing how it applies to us when we are in the market. The American Heritage Dictionary defines psychology as the study of the mental processes, behavioral characteristics, and emotions of an individual or group. Since we're interested in market losses due to psychological factors, we will examine each of the three parts of the definition as they relate to us when we have those types of losses. Therefore, the second part of this book examines the mental processes, behavioral characteristics, and emotions of people who lose money in the markets. 1. Mental processes. Chapter 6 explains what happens when a market position, especially a loss, gets personalized. It presents the difference between external, objective losses and internal, subjective losses. Next, it looks at the mental process an individual goes through when experiencing an internal loss: denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. Most people equate loss with being wrong, and therefore internalize what should be an external loss. Then they start to experience the 5 stages of internal loss, and the loss gets larger as they progress through the stages. Finally, the chapter makes a distinction between losses from discrete events, for example, games, and continuous processes, for example, markets, and shows that only the latter are subject to the 5 stages. 2. Behavioral characteristics. Chapter 7 discusses the most common way people personalize market positions. The chapter introduces the 5 types of participants in the markets: investors, traders, speculators, bettors, and gamblers. The type of participant a person is determined by the behavioral characteristics he displays, not by the activity in which he is engaged. In other words, all stock purchases are not investing, just as all card playing isn't gambling. The chapter also shows that the source of most losses in the markets is people betting or gambling, as defined by the characteristics of their behavior, on a continuous process risk activity. 3. Emotions of an individual or group. Chapter 8 explains that emotions are neither good nor bad. They simply are. Emotions per se cannot be avoided. Emotionalism, on the other hand, can and should be avoided. Emotionalism is decision-making based on emotions. The entity that best describes emotional decision-making is the crowd. The chapter explains that the crowd is the epitome of emotions in action, and discusses the crowd not in the familiar terms of contrary opinion or as a stage of a runaway market, but in terms of a process that can affect a solitary individual. Being a member of the crowd is not a function of quantity of people. Rather, it is a function of the characteristics displayed. We will also look at 2 models that describe the stages an individual passes through as he becomes a member of a psychological crowd. Six, the psychological dynamics of loss. I can't get out here. I'm losing too much. Loser's famous last words. In mid-October 1983, while the bean oil position was blowing up in my face, I got a call from my mom. Dad is going into the hospital for exploratory cancer surgery. It shouldn't be a big deal, and they don't expect a problem, but they have to take a look, she said. She called back the next day after the surgery, and the news from the doctor was that the cancer had spread through his whole body, and he had 6 months to live. They'd given him a full colostomy, and he would start going to chemo radiation therapy immediately. 2 months later, I got a call from my dad. He said, "Mom's gone. I can't find her. She left last night and hasn't come home." As it turned out, my mom had committed suicide. She had walked into the Ohio River and drowned herself. The only good news was that she didn't know I was broke, so it wasn't my situation that made her do it. She did it because my dad was so sick and going to die, and she couldn't deal with it. I'd really have been in bad shape if I'd thought that she did it because of my situation. But they had no idea that I'd gone under. Things didn't look any different. We still lived in the house and so on. I just didn't have the same job. They knew I'd had a job change, but they didn't know why. By that time, my dad was in and out of the nursing home and had a full-time nurse at home. I was driving back and forth almost every weekend, visiting him and watching him die. I would go one weekend, and my brother would go the next. Finally, in August of 1984, he died. So between August 1983 and August 1984,